This is Pablo Paredes, ex-Navy War Resister, and you're listening to 101.1 FM Freak Radio, Unembedded Reporting.
Did that work with the click?
Just the click.
On Tuesday, February 28th, War Resister Pablo Paredes did a whirlwind tour through the Central Coast, speaking at Renaissance High in two separate classrooms, at a packed house of over 100 people at CSUMB, on the air at KHDC 90.9 FM Radio Bilingüe, su Radio Bilingüe por la Costa Central, and later to a house of about 25 to 30 people in Watsonville. Pablo Paredes was a Navy sailor who refused orders to deploy to Iraq based on personal convictions that not only the Iraq War was extremely illegal both by international and domestic legal standards, but also that war is an incredible waste of life and resources. And you know, his famous quote was, "I'm guilty of believing war is a crime." So Pablo Paredes was court-martialed, disciplined, sent to hard labor, and is now touring excessively throughout the United States, bringing his message of awareness and counter-recruitment to young people so that they can make a more informed choice. Pablo speaks about how he was, you know, essentially recruited by the military through less than, shall we say, less than honest means. And you'll hear a little bit more of this. What's about to follow is a taped interview with Pablo Paredes that I did on the 28th. So again, this is War Resister Pablo Paredes being interviewed and conversating with Augusto Cesar Sandino II from Free Radio Santa Cruz. Bueno, this is Augusto Cesar Sandino II with Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1, www.freakradio.org, listed online worldwide. And I'm here today with
Pablo Paredes.
Pablo Paredes, and for those of you who don't know, maybe you've actually heard his story on Democracy Now!, which you can hear on Free Radio at 8 a.m. and 12 noon. Again, we broadcast it twice a day. But Amy Goodman did a really awesome interview with Pablo Paredes and Camilo Mejia, and I do remember we played that here on the station. So for those of you who don't know, Pablo Paredes was a Navy sailor who, you know, due to some self-education and some conversations and experiences he had while in the military, essentially defied his orders to assist in the movement of troops to Iraq. And he sat down on the dock in a very public fashion, expecting to be arrested, ended up not being. And, you know, I guess I should let you tell this story here, Pablo. Maybe you could just give us a little bit about what it was you did and kind of what drove you to do that.
Sure. What happened was, like you said, I did a lot of self-educating while I was in Japan. I left this country with the military to be stationed in Japan as an everyday Joe, you know, as mainstream as you get, you know. I worked two jobs and went to school in high school and didn't have much time in my plate for politics, and I really didn't know what was going on in the world. That my four corners told me what was going on in my life, and that's what I kind of cared about back in those days. But it was a change of scenery. I ended up in Japan and ended up meeting all kinds of new people. It's really interesting because a lot of my interest that in the United States really didn't take me that far outside of the United States. It took me to politics in a very major way. One of my major interests is salsa. I love dancing salsa. I love the music. I love some of the old artists. And once I left the States and I was in Japan, I started to meet some people that were into it too, but they really loved the Cuban blend of salsa. And I wasn't familiar with it at all. I was ignorant. I only knew, you know, the Puerto Rican and New York version.
Right? Probably don't hear a lot about it.
You don't hear about Cuba in the States, right? Because there's a major embargo. So I started kind of doing self-educating around that. And next thing you know, I start finding out about this embargo and all the cruelty attached to it. And the base in Guantanamo and all the issues surrounding Cuba. That also led me to, you know, I was doing the Caribbean overall, so it led me back to Puerto Rico, which is my hometown. My mother was born there, and I consider myself Puerto Rican. And I started to learn about Vieques, you know, the island off the coast of Puerto Rico, where we're using depleted uranium and destroying the ecosystem, and cancer rates are up the wall, you know, and it was really destroying me because this is what I worked for and believed in at the time, or so I thought. And here I am finding all these horrible truths out about the history of what the military has been used to do. So it really hurt me. And I ran across guys like Smedley Butler and, you know, right. the things they had to say about what the military
war,
was used for.
War is a racket.
Right. War is a racket. So so I got very political and I started to oppose what was happening at the time, which was the war in Iraq. I started to realize the truths behind that war that were very similar to some of the things that Smedley talked about, to some of the things that were happening in the Caribbean and in South America in general. So here I was with this major conflict in Japan, but not being directly affected because I wasn't directly taking part in the war. You know, I was over there doing a job in Japan that had nothing to do with what people were doing in Iraq, or at least not directly. So I drew a line for myself in the abstract. I just said, look, you know, no matter what happens, you know, I talked about it to my family and friends, and I said, look, you know, this is how I feel and I'm true to it. So if I'm ever asked to go to the war in Iraq, I'm not going to go. And back then, it was a really easy decision to make in some ways because I wasn't faced with the decision. I didn't have to walk the walk. I just had to talk the talk.
So
So I talked the talk, and in some ways, I didn't expect to ever have to walk the walk. I thought I'd get out of the military within a year and change, and I'd never be confronted with it. But I get to my next duty station, and I'm training to be a military police officer. And in training to do that, I would have to enlist for an extra 2 years, which was obviously not quite as horrible to me as taking part in war crimes, but it was continuing my support and my hypocrisy by working in a system that I disagree with, working in the military, which at this point is being used for such, you know, horrible things that a lot of the honor has been taken out of it.
Right.
So I said to myself, you know, I can't do either one of those things. So I was honest with my chain of command. I told him, look, this is how I feel. And I didn't know what was to come of that, but I just felt like I needed to be honest at that moment.
How did they react?
They reacted not very lovingly.
Surprise, surprise.
To say the least, my higher-ups got into like an open debate with me, and I explained what I felt. They said, I think we're committing war crimes out there. I said, I think anybody that takes part in it is being complicit to these war crimes. The higher-ups more so than us. So I don't want to be put in a position to do that. And I don't want to work in a military that is, you know, the essential vehicle to doing that. And so they got really frustrated, you know, they really believe in the message and they didn't want to debate the issues. They simply refused to believe that the military could ever be corrupted, could ever be used for something that is not a noble cause, as our president likes to call it.
Of course.
So the reaction was I got sent off. I got sent on the next possible ship that was going to go out and drop Marines off to head to Iraq. And needless to say, you know, I had already made that decision in my head, but now it was time to act on it.
Right.
So what was I going to do? Was I going to hop on the ship and, you know, be quiet about my principles, or was I going to take action? So I debated it. I talked to my family about what I was going to do and how I was going to do it. And eventually the idea came up from my fiance, you know, somebody who's been so strong in my life and such a good influence.
So she actually suggested that you.
She actually suggested it. I was thinking about crazy things. I was thinking about getting kicked out of the military by some dishonest mean, and I really didn't like the idea because here I had a principled stance and I wanted to keep it principled, and I didn't want to do something dishonest to carry it out.
Of course.
So what I decided to do was what she suggested. It seemed like, you know, Eureka came out of my mouth when she said that. I was like, oh yes.
Yeah.
This is exactly what I need to do. I need to not participate in a war that I think is illegal, and I need to say why I'm doing that and make it public and penetrate mainstream media with that message. So I did it all. You know, I got my crash course in media savvy skills, right? I started calling up action desks, which I didn't know what they were until then. For those that don't know, action desks are kind of the place to get on-the-fly information that might be used by a different media venue. So I hit all the action desks, I called up all the networks, I hit up all the guys that I thought might support what I was doing, so I started to kind of get a crash course in anti-war folks, because I really wasn't a major political person, you know. I had never gone to an anti-war rally or done a march or done anything like that, you know.
Right.
I was Mr. Mainstream. So I just had to school myself and try to make connections really quick, and in doing so, I met a lot of good people that really wanted to help me get the message out. And some of the local media and some of the Latino media especially really put forth the story.
You mentioned a lot about the international media paying more attention to your
story. Right, international media thought it was newsworthy. And the local, the U.S. media, national U.S. media didn't think it was newsworthy. And to show you the level of hypocrisy, the same corporation made different moves when it came to local and international news. Because CNN en Español was all over my story. They did more than one set of coverage for it.
Wow.
Whereas CNN National didn't want to hear about it.
But you could speak both languages, right?
Yeah, wasn't a language issue.
Yeah.
It was a prepackaged message issue. That's what it was. So,
what did that teach you about kind of like the media environment in which we exist when it comes to government policies?
Right. Going back to Japan, I realized for myself, and this is funny to realize in Japan, because Japan's media is you know, no saint. Japan's media still goes back to World War II, is very consolidated ownership. They have something that is pretty much embedded reporting in their in a domestic sense, because they have these press clubs, and the press clubs essentially work in the State Department. They work under state officials, and they only report what state officials give them. They have no private investigators that are autonomous that show up and report on a presidential press conference, for example. No.
Wow.
These guys work and, you know, do all of their work.
They get their paycheck from the
White House,
reporting.
Right. Right. So it's incredibly embedded. And even there, even in this country that is to that level, you know, and we have our hand in that. General MacArthur really liked that system that was used for propaganda in World War II, and so he kept it in place when we took over.
Yeah.
But anyway, even in that scenario, in that place where, you know, media is not at all, you know, this autonomous, free, you know, watchdog.
Supposedly,
right? I still felt like the amount of consolidation of media and the power of media in the United States was something incredible when I was in Japan, because I got to see different perspectives. Obviously, this consolidated media in Japan didn't mind reporting a little bit of truth about what was happening in Iraq, because it wasn't their war, right? And this was before Koizumi decided to send the self-defense forces there. So there was no issues around this war. They were free to report on it, right?
Right.
So they were reporting the things as they were happening. Robert Frist stories were making their way into Japanese news. And I was starting to see what was really going on in Iraq. And then I would look at, you know, turn the page and go on the CNN online or something like that.
Read about Gary Condrit or Chandler Levy.
And I'd be like, what is this? It's like a whole different world. It's like two completely different planets talking about the same thing, right? And I just couldn't understand how different the media coverage was.
Yeah.
And it made me realize how consolidated our media is, how much ownership there is, and these same people own the, you know, the military-industrial complex type corporations.
General Electric,
you know,
owning NBC.
General Electric owns NBC, owns all these different news venues, and it also owns all these weapons manufacturers.
Right.
So they're conflicted. They can't possibly report on the war objectively. So definitely, I mean, and in my trial, that became very obvious. All the things that happened that were not friendly to the military were not reported on.
I think the military definitely learned its lesson to an extent in Vietnam. And I've been told, obviously I wasn't alive at that time, but the difference in media coverage between, say, the Vietnam War and the first Iraq War were just, you know, apples and oranges, worlds apart.
Right.
The press was very controlled and contained and essentially told what to report, much more so in the first Iraq War. And again, this process has been evolved into, you know, as you said, embedded reporting.
Where, right, the Gulf War was like the trial run.
Yeah.
That's when they first started to sanitize it and give you embedded kind of
really cool,
you know,
cameras mounted on the front of missiles. So
right,
you just fly
looking like
target.
A video game,
yeah,
and all of that. And they saw how successful it was. The opposition to the first Gulf War was minimal compared to what it would have been had the reporting looked anything like Vietnam or past reporting.
Right.
So yeah, it was a trial run, and they felt it was successful, and they went all out on this one.
Word, couldn't agree more. And that's why we do Free Radio Santa Cruz here, which you're listening to, you know. Obviously you're listening now, so you don't need to be told about the media environment too much more. Let's talk a little bit more about the moral and legal arguments that you made against the war, because I found those in you know, like she talked a little bit about.
Well, yeah, we were just recently at an interview where we talked about that, the international law aspect. And, you know, I always like to make it very clear that these aren't, you know, abstract issues that, you know, intellectuals and lawyers and international lawyers and UNN type folks have to debate to death. You know, this is very basic stuff. anybody can go online right now and they can check out, you know, the United Nations website, and they can see what the charter looks like. It's there. They can go to the different articles. I believe it's somewhere in the 40s and 51 or something like that, that explain exactly when it is that any member nation can go to war if they honor their contract, if they honor the treaties of, you know, the UN Charter, which we have ratified.
Right.
Not only co-signed, we ratified it. We turned it into supreme law of our land according to our constitution. So, you know, you can be in ninth grade and still understand this stuff. It's not, you know, rocket science. You can read it. It's very clearly stated, and it says very basically two ways you can go to war. One is in self-defense. There's nobody on our beaches. I think that's pretty clear to anybody. The second is if the Security Council of the United Nations votes for it. We have an incredible influence on that Security Council. We make sure people we don't like don't get on that Security Council. And even with that incredible influence that we have on the Security Council, we were not able to yield it in our direction. And we were not, and when I say we, I'm talking about our government, I'm talking about George W. Bush, and I'm talking also about Tony Blair, were not able to force them to sign a resolution allowing for the war. They didn't. They refused to. And that should be telling in and of itself.
Right.
The international community did not agree with the war. So those are two reasons when you can go to war, two places where you can go to war if you've signed on to the United Nations, and the U.S. has, and they benefit very much so from having signed on there and wielding the kind of influence that they wield in the United Nations. So you can't have it both ways. If you're going to be a part of the United Nations, if you're going to believe in this system and use it to force other countries to do things that are convenient to you, then when it comes down to waging war, you're going to have to abide by international standards. And this war doesn't abide by those standards.
Of course, if you're like a total hypocrite.
Right. And it's illegal, more important than anything. It's illegal under international law. And like I said, that's been codified into the Constitution that any treaties we sign becomes the supreme law of the land. So it's illegal under our national law.
Exactly. Why is the work that you're doing now important for young people to hear, and the message you're trying to get across? Like, you know, why are you doing this?
Well, I put the premium on going to the local high schools, well, not local, but to the urban high schools and to the impoverished areas with this message. Why? Because that's where I came from. And so I have a firsthand knowledge of exactly how targeted, as Latinos, as African Americans, Southeast Asians, all the minority groups, and even the white folks that are impoverished, that live in more poor neighborhoods, the urban neighborhoods, we're targeted. There's a big fat bullseye on our foreheads and we don't even know it. Recruiters love us. They know that we don't have educational opportunities, that we have, you know, a tough exterior from the poor, you know, kind of areas that we grow up in. And so it's easier to appeal to our, you know, want to fulfill these tough guy kind of stereotypes and these machismo type roots. And it's easier to get us because we don't have opportunities. So they sell us on all these so-called opportunities that there are in the military. And no one else is painting a clearer picture of it. There's only one person talking to us about it. Our parents don't really know about the situation. There's nobody coming in and doing some kind of objective, independent case about what military life is like, about what the recruitment, about what kind of lies or truths the recruiters are telling. All we have is a recruiter coming into our high school telling us what's good about the Navy and trying to sell us on it. I make the analogy often that if you want to buy a car, you don't go to Honda and ask them what's good and bad about Honda. You do the research on your own. You show up to the dealership once you've decided this is the car you want. And then you sign a contract with this guy, but you don't let him educate you on which is the best car. He's going to tell you his every time. He's not going to tell you anything wrong with that car. And that's what essentially we're forced into with military recruitment. We're forced into having a Honda dealership sell us a car, only it's a lot more serious than that, because it's not a car we're buying, it's our life we're signing over. We're signing off the possibility of even dying in a war. And the only person telling us the do's and don'ts of that are military recruiters. And that's simply ridiculous. And somebody has to counteract that. And so coming from that environment and knowing what that can produce, I've made it my mission. I've made it my mission to go to as many high schools in as many areas like my own to try and balance that message and to try to say, look, this is what I've seen with my own eyes. This is what also happens. This is what they're not telling you about. And even if I don't have to try and convince them in my direction, I just like to pose the questions that they never are forced to answer. I like to ask them, how many people died in the war in Iraq? You know, how many people have the chance of dying? How many people actually get this job that you like to sell so much? You know, all these questions that they never get asked. And then when the students have that, they become empowered and they take their own course with it. But they need to have that balancing force.
Yeah. I mean, how do they receive the message? I mean, you kind of touched on it a little bit, but I mean, you're generally well received then?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, we don't give enough credit to young people. Young people are so much smarter than adults sometimes. I mean, really, really. Like, I walk in there, and recently we had a debate inside of a high school. It was Skyline High School, and the military went all out when they heard it was a debate. They sent their top gun. This guy is the commander of the Northern California area of recruitment. He's obviously got a college degree. He's got, I don't know how many years under his belt, probably around 20. You know, the guy is very educated. Here I am with some college under my belt, you know, young guy, probably haven't spoken in public as much as this guy, probably, you know, a little more educated in the academic sense. And I said to myself, you know, someone else might be intimidated by this situation, but I know I got truth on my side. So I'm just going to speak the truth and see what happens. And the kids, they read right through this guy, no matter how much education he received and how much info he has and how many statistics he tried to throw out to look like he knows what he's talking about. They saw right through what he was talking about. As long as they have a balancing act, it'll be very easy to see. But it's a lot harder to see when there's only one side.
Right. And on top of just getting that one side, they have the massive military budget that's constantly advertising, seeking out their hangout spots or I mean, whatever it might be.
Yeah, I like to make sure that they know the numbers. One of the big numbers is they're spending $60,000 on every person they recruit. $60,000. The most prominent colleges with the biggest budgets for recruitment spend maybe $3,000 on the people they recruit, maybe $6,000. That's about a tenth of what the military is spending. You know, it's a lose-lose situation for our, and in high schools like the one I grew up in that are really impoverished, the colleges don't spend anything. They don't even bother going because they know the kids can't afford college. So your only option ends up being by what you're exposed to, the military.
You stated earlier that speaking of the military budget, you stated earlier that the United States spends more on its military in a year than the whole rest of the world combined.
Combined. And that's just scary.
How does that make you feel?
Understand? Yeah, how many nations have a working military? And if you add up all of their budgets, every single one of them, it does not add up to the U.S. military budget. That is just a staggering figure. And I think kids have to know that. They have to know that's what they're up against. You know, that budget includes a recruitment budget that is larger than any military in the world, any military added up. Their recruitment budget at this point is higher than a lot of the main corporations' advertising budgets. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
When somebody's spending more money than McDonald's to get you to join their program, that's scary. That's very scary.
What about the interactions of your fellow, you know, enlisted service people? How was your action received?
Well, I like to make it very clear to people outside of the military because a lot of times we have a picture of the military that's distorted. We have this homogenous kind of action movie flick picture of what being a member of the military is all about. And everybody's got an M16 glued to their hip. And, you know, we all live in trenches and eat MREs and that's all there is to it. And we all have one opinion politically and that's all there is to it. And that's not the way it is. It's a very, very diverse community. Just like society. I mean, it's in some ways it is reflective of society in that sense. There's people from all walks of life with all kinds of political opinions. And just like in society, you know, some of the poorer areas, we get the harder jobs. And in the military, that doesn't mean slaving over a hot stove. It means possibly dying in war. And some of the more aloof classes do get in the military, and they tend to have some of the better jobs. They tend to be the lawyers and the medics and things like that.
After they've gone to school,
Right. And they have the option of resigning, and the lower class folks don't have the option of resigning. We're contractually bound in the so-called volunteer army. So it's very interesting, and it's something that you have to be aware of when you talk about the reaction of people, because the reaction has been in every way. I've had people that are completely against. I've had people that are completely for, want to give me a hug and a handshake because they think it's very important and it's very courageous. I have people that think I'm a coward. So it goes from one extreme to the other, just like the debate does in the real world. You know, the far right is going to call me a coward. The left is going to say that this was a courageous stand. So, I mean, the spectrum of debate is just as wild, as open as it is in regular society.
But they're certainly not able to express themselves as freely.
Right. That's where the big difference comes in. In my community, for example, which happens to be a community where, you know, folks are not in a very dangerous job. They don't have as much of a systemic brainwashing effect happening because nobody's talking them into dying. So they don't need to be these, you know, flag-following foot soldiers. Whereas in the Marines, for example, there's a hard propaganda campaign. The military wants to make sure these guys do not diverge from the line. So they really campaigned to kind of glue their brains into, this is what you have to believe, and this is the way it is, and this is a great war, and there's nothing wrong with it. And it's, you know, it's a very aggressive campaign of propaganda. Whereas in my branch, it's a very technical branch. A lot of people get in and get out just for doing the job and having a paycheck, and it's not as dangerous. So there's not as much of a propaganda fight to keep us in a certain line. So where I was at, most of the people agreed with me. Most of them wouldn't go as far as I went because they don't want to lose their jobs. They don't want to, you know, they have families and kids to feed and things like that. And I'm not one to judge anybody for that. But they do agree. Behind the scenes, all kinds of people agreed. I had definitely more support than I did people antagonizing when it came to my action in my community.
Wow. I'm a young person thinking of joining the military. I don't think I have any other options. I want to get out. I want to see the world. I can't go to school. I can't afford it. What do you say to me?
I see there's, you know, it's really funny because society in some sense, and even some of us, because we know, you know, when I say us, I mean people that work for justice, for peace, and some level of equality in the future. We know all of the problems systemically, right? So we talk a lot about how there's reduced opportunities for inner city kids and things like that. But I think in some ways we do ourselves a disservice, because the fact is there still are opportunities. The military makes up less than 1% of the American population. What does that mean? That means that more than 99% of the American population, and that includes a whole lot of poor people, somehow find a way to make it every day without joining the military. And I say to people that start to feel that way, there's got to be a way. There's a million ways. There's a million opportunities. The recruiter would love for you to think that there's no other opportunity but the military, and they're going to sell you on that. A lot of them come around and they talk about, oh, you want to work at McDonald's for the rest of your life or something like that. And they really glue that into your brain, and people start to buy it. People start to think that this is the only way they're going to make it out. And it's not true. And not only is it not true that it's the only way, but it's not necessarily a way to make it out either. Because I can't tell you how many times I've seen guys that go to the military and come out of the military and they're broke as a joke, and now they have no skills and they're too old to learn a new skill. Could you imagine 40 years old after 20 years of military life not having any kind of marketable skill, no education, and trying to start from scratch at 40? It's no joke.
Yeah, that's true.
Real important
signal. Tell me now. Hey, how you doing? This is Pablo Paredes, ex-Navy war resister, and you're listening to 101.1 FM Freak Radio Unembedded Reporting.
Try that again, dude. This is Augusto Cesar Sandino II, and you have just listened to an interview with Pablo Paredes, war resister, conscientious objector, and activist against the war, counter-recruiter. For more information about Pablo Paredes, please visit www.swiftsmartveterans.org. For more information about resisting the military, and for assistance, both legal and otherwise, with your enlistment agreement, the delayed entry program, or alternatives and other opportunities for young people besides military service, please contact locally the Resource Center for Nonviolence and nationally the GI Rights Hotline at 1-800-395-9544. The Resource Center is available online at www.rcnv.org. The background beats for this interview were provided by The Genie. Please check out www.thegeniemusic.com. Again, this is Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org, an unlicensed community radio station defying the FCC's misregulation of our public airwaves.